Hi, so this week I spoke with Max Chapnick about Anne Carson's verse narrative autobiography of Red, which was a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed talking to Max about this. Max is in Wellington at the moment. He's just completed an MA in creative writing. He's normally from New York, and I believe he's returning to New York, but he's just been great having him here. I first met him when I was working at the administration office at Modern Letters. He popped in, and yeah, ever since he's just been such a great addition to the Wellington literary community. He's a fantastic poet. He's a really great reader, and he's just been involved. It's been lovely having him here. He also has dual degrees. He has a degree in physics and English, which I think comes out in the podcast. So I talked to him about this verse narrative. This podcast, when I listen back to it, is basically just punctuated by me kind of losing my mind over things that he said. Max completed a verse narrative as part of his MA, we talk about that. And this podcast just kind of left me wanting more of non-conventional and non-traditional narratives. I just left thinking, how else can we break this form? It was just wonderful talking to him, and and it just added to the enjoyment of the book for me. The book is fantastic, but talking about the book is great as well. Max is also, I should say, he's got a work in Rejectamenta, which is an online collection of rejected work. That is a small project that Emma Barnes and I put together under the framework of Cats and Spaghetti, which is sort of like a little press we're doing stuff through. And Rejectamenta includes work that has been previously rejected from other literary journals, and also the rejection letters that were associated with the work. So I'll leave a link on the website so that you can have a look at that. The other thing that Max is doing, which is coming up soon, is he and Ben Edgerton are editing Turbine, which is the Modern Letters online journal, and I'll leave a link for that. Ben told me the date that it goes live. I think it's around December 7 or 8. But if you just keep checking, there's a lot of older editions which are really good to read as well. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this chat. I found it incredibly motivating as a writer and as a reader. And yeah, it was really great to talk to Max. And so enjoy it. Hello, I'm sitting here with Max, and we are in his office up at Victoria University in the Stout Centre, and it's a drizzly kind of day, but there's a bird tweeting in the tree, so you might hear that, which would be quite nice. Max, now, I heard about this book years before I read it, I built it up really big in my mind. And then I read it. I borrowed Kirsten MacDougall's copy of it, actually. And I read it, and it blew my mind in places, and also I felt confused by it in places as well. And I was just wondering, like, we were just reading a little bit from your journal, and I was just wondering, like, how did you stumble on it? Had you heard about it before you read it, or, yeah, how did that go?
So I had been thinking about writing a long verse narrative, and so a professor I had at my old university recommended reading Anne Carson generally, even though she had never read Anne Carson.
Mm-hmm.
as sort of like, well, this is a poet that people keep telling me to read, but I haven't actually ever read. And then when I got here, I'm not sure if this is true, but I think I remember talking to Anne Kennedy after the Readers and Writers Festival and saying how I loved her book, Time of Giants, and she said, well, I stole a lot of the form from Anne Carson, and so I had heard about it from her. And then when I first asked Helen, who's my supervisor, Helen Heath, for some books, she gave me this one and said, you should definitely read this.
So mm-hmm.
Sort of a snowball of recommendations.
I think that was my experience as well with it. I like that idea of a snowball. Yeah, like it was kind of like, I sort of had this idea of Anne Carson's, and then I had the idea of the book, and then when I finally read it, it was a really interesting experience. Can you remember your first experience of it? Like, we were just reading that thing. I don't know, like...
Oh, yeah. So I remember it was a bit of a struggle, actually, for me, because I think I had also been reading a lot of Dorothy Porter around this time, so reading, like, very immersive, more immersive narratives, poetic narratives,
mm-hmm.
and this is a little bit more resistive, so, yeah.
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 So when you say resistive, do you mean that it has that effect of sort of pushing you out rather than hugging you in, or...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that... Yeah, I think it's like a spectrum. So there's some, and it's probably the same with fiction too.
Mm-hmm.
There's some books that like really you're like with the character, you like feel everything the character's feeling. And then there are some books where you're sort of like looking at it from like a bird's
mm-hmm.
eye view.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is a little bit more that, I think.
Yeah. Because I had a similar kind of experience, because when I was reading it, I was also reading Savage Detectives by Bolaño. So it was this weird crossover where people were kind of sleeping on roofs, but it was, I think that's exactly the experience I had, where one, I would just read and forget where I was, the other one, I never forgot that I was reading a work of literature, you know, I never forgot that there were pages between me, which is kind of an interesting thing. Do you think you can tease that out a little bit and talk about maybe why the book is resistive like that?
I think it's really weird, and it's self-consciously weird,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, there's this guy who's a Greek mythological figure, who's red, who has wings in, like, the 21st century. So
mm-hmm.
it's like, it's this... intentional dislocation.
Mm.
So I think there's just the situation of it is sort of disconcerting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like that sort of thing's really interesting about the book is that what I remember about it was there was that push me, pull you kind of tug where I wasn't ever allowed to forget that he was red and had wings and all that. But there was this weird, every now and then I would read and feel... I don't even know how to put it, but feel kind of these human emotions that felt like they would be better suited for an immersive kind of book, yet you know, then I'd feel like an idiot because it, you know, the next line, you know, like it was a really bizarre experience reading it for me.
Yeah, I love that thing where you're like, where you are sort of immersed and then you pull back.
Yeah,
like I remember the scene, I think this is very early on, where he's with his brother and it's like kind of abusive and you're feeling the like the discomfort of a child in that situation, and then he just like jumps off the bed and he's running to his mother, and then you picture like a little red boy running on the floor, and then it's really weird.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, what I'm always interested in, because, you know, like, I mean, I think that is a really good project for a writer, and like, I love reading books that are like that. And then I get this strange thing where, and I don't even know if this is right, but that depends so much on reader reception, doesn't it? Like that, and I mean, how... Like, yeah, I don't know who can answer this, but I'd be interested to hear you talk about it. Like, sometimes I'm writing and I think, have I given away too much? Have I not given away enough? You know, like, how does this sit? Do you have anything to say about that? And, you know, like, sort of the idea of being a writer, as you are, but sort of as, you know, as a reader, there's all this weird enjoyment out of it. And I just, yeah, do you think about audience when you're writing? That's what this question is.
Yeah.
Do you think about audience when you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm like a real writer yet, but...
you wrote all that stuff.
Yeah.
You're in now.
yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the workshop process, right? Like, I wrote this verse narrative, and then in my first workshop, everyone was like, oh yeah, it's great, but I'd like a little bit more background.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to set up this character. I don't
mm-hmm.
feel as connected with your main character as I should, and I want, you know, how is he going to space, whatever. And then in the next workshop, they were like, too much. It's too
mm-hmm.
much background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I know yet how audiences receive work, or maybe it depends on Yeah, it depends on the context of what they're reading and why they're reading it.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting as well, because I think I was just thinking of what Anne Kennedy said about it, and like I think that's often how I do it as well, is that I will I don't know what this says about me, but I will completely dissect something to see how they've done it, you know, and I will copy it absolutely. You know, like I remember doing that with this short story that I've got where I just copied a Chekhov story, but bought it in, you know, like copied the exact structure of each sentence and stuff like that. And I wonder if that's part of it as well, is like that scene, I remember it really clearly. And yeah, just that slight detail that goes, nah, sorry, he's red, he's got wings. Blah, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It's quite weird. That weirdness. And you mentioned Dorothy Porter. Porter. Yeah. Yes, brilliant. I am so well read. I'm just wondering, like, the verse narrative, does it have more space for oddness, do you think, than, like, I'm wondering, like, you wrote a verse narrative, and I'm wondering what it gave you that perhaps a suite of poems or a book of, you know, like, what did it give you that you didn't, that, you know, yeah.
I think you can do things. Yeah, I think you can do things that you can't do in either a narrative or a poem.
Mm.
Yeah. Like, I don't think my story is particularly, like, narratively brilliant at all. I think it's fairly trope, and it's self-consciously a trope of a sci-fi narrative.
Yeah.
It knows that it's pretty typical, and it sort of resists that in certain ways. And then the poetry is also not... I don't think it's even some of my best poetry, but because it's sort of these two things combined together, it makes it something that's maybe better, bigger than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because that's some, I mean, that was what was interesting. Like, I was reading excerpts this morning from the Carson book, and I was sort of like, I was really surprised. And that's what I remember a lot about the process of reading the book, is that the verse itself is not easy. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's another book, another verse narrative that I've read, and now I will forget it. And it is by a Welsh man. Oh, I've just forgotten it. Anyway, Garth Maxwell. And that has a very regular... Glenn Maxwell, thank you. Yes,
yeah.
Yes, that's it. But that has a very regular kind of meter. And as you're reading it, it's a really odd experience as well, because you're kind of reading about punks and very 21st century stuff, but you're reading about it in this meter, which just is absolutely... it just keeps you going and, you know, it's relentless. Yeah. Whereas, can you talk a little bit... Like, is there form in there that I'm not noticing? Is, you know, like, even if you just open a page, you know, like, if we open a page, like, you know, the lines look relatively this, you know, we're on page 70, so it goes long line, short, you know, I just, I mean, is there meter in there, or, yeah, I don't know.
I think that's the standard style for the whole book, long line, short line.
Yeah.
And then she also has these... sentences that start each poem. I'm going to call them poems. I don't know, chapter. That start, and then there's a little break, and then it's long line, short line. Yeah, so it is free verse. It's not, you know, it's not end rhymes or metered, strict meters. But I think there's a form. I think she does care about the line breaks, and one thing that I think she does really well is verbs. She's very good at verbs.
Yeah.
In general, a lot of poets, I think, care less about verbs. I don't know. I think there is a free verse form. I started writing my poem in rhyming couplets.
Yeah.
And then I decided to get rid of them in favor of free verse, because it's just much easier to do a story, I think, in free verse. Like, you can maintain some poetic influence.
Mm.
But if you have to struggle with every line, it's maybe you could do it, but it would take you so long.
And I think that's what I really enjoy about this, I think, is that it sings. Like, there's a musicality there that is not... Because that was one thing I remember extremely about it, was even just the impact of the line break and the line break and the line break, there was a musicality to it that seemed to, and I don't know if this is just me kind of I don't know, I come from a family where we don't read a lot of poetry, but I sort of value poetry more emotionally or something. And I felt like there were places where the line break would be so poignant. And I think that might be another thing. Yeah, is that another thing that you can bring to a narrative through verse that perhaps you can't through prose lines that go all the way to the end of the sentence?
Yeah, definitely. And then also, for example, like in Dorothy Porter, her lines are tiny.
Yeah.
So then you're sort of, if you find a good line break, you can step out of the poem for a second and think, oh yeah, that's a great word to end that line. Like, look at the economy of sentences and the perfect sort of diction that she's using.
Mm.
So it's the same with this. These lines are a bit longer, but I think that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also there's other there's other poetic devices in it, not just, you know, line breaks. Like there's, I remember I think it's the guy he meets in Peru with the beard has like a mouth that looks like a nipple because his beard is like, there's just like the little, you know, little metaphor symbols that are pretty brilliant.
Cause that's yeah, like I was just thinking about how I don't know, this always happens when I talk about these things, is that I think, that was a great book, and then I talk to someone and I'm like, man, that was amazing, that was incredible. But I think, I was just thinking about that thing where it is, like, I always get jealous of people that write songs. Like, I feel like, oh, that's not fair. They can do, like, a minor shift or, you know, like, they can make it beautiful, and I've just got words. And then when I read something like this, I feel like there's this layering of other things on top of the story, like what you're saying, which I think is so interesting.
Yeah, and also the framework for it too, like the first 20 pages are, you know, these, I don't even know if it's, I don't even know if these are real. I think some of them are actually real fragments, but then there's the essay and then this little sort of poem / essay about Helen. So
yeah.
She does provide sort of a context for the main character that you wouldn't necessarily need for this to still work, but it just makes it all the more better.
Yeah. And do you this is another thing that I struggled with because I felt stupid. But this layering of classical, you know, like Heracles is in there, and then there's, you know, this kind of layering of classical stuff, which I don't, it's really interesting because the book came out in 98, and this idea of putting sort of classical reference into poetry, I mean, it always makes me think of Ezra Pound and, you know, like that kind of wanting to, T.S. Eliot, like kind of trying to rebuild a new Rome or something. But I wonder, how do you read those in 1998 and how do we read them in 2014? Like,
yeah, I think she gets a lot of credibility though for the fact that she actually is a professor of Greek and teaches Greek. So it's almost like she's an expert at the tradition that she's using in her layering.
Yeah.
So that's okay, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's really interesting because it's not focusing on the mythology. I think it's focusing on the story.
Which is
one of the reasons I really liked it a lot, because there still is, you know, character development and plot and things like that, and then this is just an additional sort of piece that makes it interesting that you could maybe go off on a little tangent down if you were so inclined.
Because I know for me it's really interesting because I do wonder about these classical allusions because I do wonder yeah, I guess it's also like biblical allusions, like I wonder what we can, what's the word, I don't know, what can we guarantee that people know? You know, and I know, you know, when I came to it, you know, like I did ancient history for a while, but I've never done classics. But when I see, you know, when I see some of these names, I just think of, like, Clash of the Titans. Like, I think of that kind of thing. And I think that's really interesting as well, because the book seems to give you the space for that as well. You know, like, if you're thinking Clash of the Titans, that's okay as well. You know, like, whereas if you do speak Greek and understand Greek, you know, that's something else as well.
So, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but the poet, Stesicheros, or whatever, writes about the 10 labors of Hercules, which is something that most people know about, Hercules and his 10 labors and whatever. But then if you, like, zoom in on the individual labor and all the associated myths with this particular character, and then you can get really specific. But there is sort of the broad framework that, I don't want to say that everybody knows, but most people probably know about Hercules. Mm. So at least you have that entry point into the mythology. So you could say, oh yeah, I know sort of what she's talking about. And then if you wanted to, I guess you could just look it up. Yeah.
Because there's a really interesting thing, the way that it goes to Peru. I just find it really interesting that in one, like, this is the sort of thing I absolutely adore, is that in one book we can have that, but we can also have the, you know, the very 20th century kind of living on the street, you know, like,
yeah,
all that sort of stuff together.
Yeah, I love that. And that, and the fact that, right, it's all about volcanoes, so then she's referencing a volcano that's maybe in Greece. I think they're from Greece, but it's unclear because they're speaking English, and then the volcano in Peru somehow is associated with blood, and so there's this connection between volcanoes of different cultures and the mythology associated with volcanoes of different cultures. And then she opens it with an epigraph from Emily Dickinson, which is about a volcano. And so then you have this whole sort of the symbolism of volcanoes in Emily Dickinson, which is completely unrelated. Or, I don't know, maybe Emily Dickinson was also referencing the Greek mythology.
Yeah.
So then you have this sort of interwoven references.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm interested, like, I really, one thing I love about this book is that, like, so many books I read, like, on first reading I'm feeling, what's the word, I don't even know what it is, but I'm feeling a little, I don't know, and then all of a sudden I go away, I'm like, okay, read that, and then it just haunts me, and I'm going back to it, and I'm like, oh, no, not that guy, and that guy, and I'm just, I don't know, like, I'm not sure, that's an incredible thing for a book to do, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
And it wasn't like I ever thought I'd stop reading it, I never got to a point where I thought, oh, and I threw it away, but yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah, I've read it, I think, maybe 4 times this year, and better each, it was better each time, I think, because, not because you know what's going to happen, but because having already digested the plot, you can focus on the little things, like the little brilliant moments, and, you know, just like they're eating the guinea pig or whatever, that's like such a weird thing, and then instead of focusing on the big thing, instead of constantly wanting to know what he's doing next, you're thinking about all those little symbols. Yeah.
Yeah, which is so cool. I did talk to you about this before, but I'm really interested in your process of writing a verse narrative. Like, did you come into the MA expecting to write a verse narrative? Is it something you've thought about for a while? Or, yeah, how did you come to find yourself writing it?
I don't even remember.
One crazy night eating guinea pigs. It was just crazy.
I don't know. I think I started, I started my proposal for the MA was to write poems about science.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I took a few papers at university just before I graduated about immersion, and I was really interested in the process of sort of the cognitive science of how does one, and these were fiction, but how does one sort of get into a book, and how does a writer write such that somebody gets into a book? So I sort of had this weird, like, fascination with, okay, well, can I be a poet and also have that, you know, is that possible? So that's sort of, I guess, how it started.
Can you talk a little bit more about that cognitive process? That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while now, but it's sort of that idea that, like, the reader and the character, the reader mirrors the character's emotions. Mm-hmm. So if the character, I mean, we did a lot of fantasy and sci-fi novels. Mm-hmm. So if the character is in a situation where, and these are sometimes over-the-top, you know, descriptions of characters' feelings, but if the character is feeling this thing really strongly, their heart is beating faster, then sometimes the reader's heart is actually beating faster. So there's this mirroring process. And empathy is also really important. So not sympathy, but where you actually feel as though you are the character experiencing those things.
Mm.
So I wanted to try to get that a little bit in poems, which aren't really known for that phenomenon.
And why do you think they're not known for it?
I don't know. I think there's like this, I think the lyric as a form is just taken over poetry.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's pretty much, you know, that's the 20th, 21st century model of a poem is this short little thing, that's a poem.
Yeah.
You know, a little, I think Tracy Smith says, like, it's a little thing, you know, a little present wrapped in a bow, and you give it to somebody and they unwrap the bow and they're like, oh, delightful, and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's a poem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
because it's really interesting hearing you talk about that immersion, because there's a writer who I'm probably going to misquote, I think his name is Frank O'Connor, but he wrote a book called The Lonely Voice, which is about short stories. They're a set of lectures that he wrote, and he argues a very similar thing about the fact that when we read a novel, it's like, I am this person. Whereas when you read a short story, we say, this is my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about that slight disconnect that often happens in short stories. And he used all these classic ideas, you know, like very good short stories to sort of explain it. And, you know, like I often never know where to put short story in the equation that is, I don't know, long form prose versus lyric poetry, you know what
yeah.
I mean? And I don't know if it sits to, I'm drawing a line, that's not helpful for a podcast, but you know, whether it sits like away from the novel and the poem, or whether it sits in between the poem and the novel. And then I read something like this, and I think maybe this is what I've always wanted to be doing. Maybe I was writing short stories, but I really want to write something like this. But I'm not a poet.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, I think short stories are probably very similar in that they, there's a sense of removal. If you know you're only going to be reading for 20 pages,
yeah,
yeah, it's like you don't want to invest all of your, you know, emotional effort in that,
yeah,
in that story. Yeah.
Because yeah. That's what I think is interesting about this as well. You know, like, is that it's a short book, you know, and I think, you know, what am I trying to say? This is such a stupid thing to say, but, you know, again, there was that thing, I think that was a lot of what kept me reading, as I was thinking, I'm not sure if I was faced with a 500-page
yeah.
version of this, if I would be able to, you know, like, because I think, yeah, I just really, I don't know, like, I think this whole idea is so interesting, like, what pushes you out and what brings you in, and, yeah, this idea of empathy. So, sorry, I'll take you back to that. So you were looking at whether you could write immersive poetry.
Yeah.
And then you thought, hey, I'm going to write a verse narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just going to shut the window. Someone started, like, a leaf blower. All right, leaf blowers of the world.
Yeah, there's a lot of construction happening.
Yeah, it's
quite
exciting.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, yeah, sorry. So if I just take you back so that we can kind of... So you came in, and then did a poem just get longer and longer, or, like...
Yeah, well, I sort of knew that I was going to... I actually started... I think the first one I read was Time of Giants, which is by Anne Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
which is a great one, and sort of mimics Autobiography of Red in a lot
yeah.
of ways. It's
yeah.
got the long short lines, which is brilliant. I don't want to give away the ending, but it sort of works with the content brilliantly.
Awesome.
And I thought, well, that would be really, that's a way to do it, because I was immersed in her story, in this character who is similar to this character is sort of misplaced in a
yeah.
world that they don't belong in, which is that she's a giant lady and she has to deal with, like, this romantic interest at being really tall, so she fakes the person into thinking that she's not as tall as she is, which is really cool. But yeah, so I was thinking, like, oh yeah, I want to do that. I want to get that feeling of immersion and also lyric play.
Yeah.
So I just, and originally I actually had a really strict form. I did it in rhyming couplets,
yeah.
and I had sort of a number of lines for each poem. It was sort of like the luminaries, like each poem
yeah.
was exactly in this ascending and descending order.
Awesome.
And then Helen sort of said to me, this is too much, you're spending too much time on the form.
Yeah.
And you should spend more time on the lyricism and the narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, so that's what I got rid of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. So now it's more free verse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually, you know, there's a lot of long lines, short lines in it. But,
yeah,
yeah. yeah. But I also copied a few other, I copied Dorothy Porter, I copied Anne Kennedy, and I copied Christopher Reed's.
Oh,
Song
yeah.
Lunch, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about Dorothy Porter?
Yeah, so Dorothy Porter is just these teeny lines. And she wrote a detective novel,
yeah.
and she wrote sort of this sappy, love story verse novel, and she wrote almost a psychological thriller in all in verse narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've read the detective story, and I was just like, what? This is amazing.
Yeah.
Is she Australian?
Yeah.
I remember, it was an Australian friend that got me onto it, Natasha Dennison. Yeah, she got me onto it. I was just like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So good. So that's interesting. Okay, now I'm going to take another straw person. That idea that, because when I think of verse narrative, I do think first about Dorothy Porter, and this idea of taking a troped, you know, like a familiar shape of a story. And did you say, it sounds like yours is quite science fiction-y.
Yeah. I mean, it's, so it's the, you know, science fiction space. It's, the subtitle is A Space Opera.
Awesome.
Yeah. So
awesome.
It's, that's a sort of a style in sci-fi novels.
Yeah.
In which it's sort of this grand sweeping narrative, and there's one character who sort of grows up in it.
Yeah.
And that's the, it's like a Buildings Roman, but with like the world being destroyed.
Yeah. And so that's interesting, you know, obviously that's interesting to me, because I'm really interested in sort of like in this book, An Autobiography of Red, we take the, you know, we take Hercules and we take those sorts of things and we put them in there, and then you take a trope that's slightly less ancient, nonetheless in place and bring it in. What am I trying to say? Again, you know, this question that I seem to ask with boring repetitiveness, what does it give you to bring a trope like that into your work? Like, what does that...
Yeah, I think it makes it... I think it's easy for verse narratives because you don't have as much... You don't have as many words, obviously.
Yeah.
So you can't set up the whole world. You sort of have to... It's like that concept in art where you, like, draw one brick and it implies the whole building.
So
if I'm writing a space opera and I say, you know, there's a virus, then you have, like, you think of all the movies, Contagion, and, you know, all the movies where the virus kills everybody. And then you just, it, I don't have to say, you know, such and such was, I don't have to describe it even as, like, fiction. Or if I think there's a reference to also The Handmaid's Tale, because it's sort of about governments, you know, controlling people and whatnot. So if I do that, then I don't have to describe the whole, like, 1984 situation.
Yeah.
And that's not, and that isn't really the point of the verse narrative. It's sort of about this journey into space. So if I can get rid of all the, you know, background really quickly with these references to past things, then it makes the whole thing easier. Yeah.
You just blew my mind slightly. I was just thinking about how we use these connotations, and we build, you know, I mean, it's very, is it Bath, or is it, oh God, it's one of those dudes, but you know, like, this idea that we can use, like, short, what would you call them, it's like a coded language, and it's like, when I say virus, you say, you know, that, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's the same in physics, too, right, like,
is it?
Yeah, and I was, well, I've been researching the R Angels, okay, so I've been talking a lot of physicists, too, and they say, well, we can't speak to other people about physics in the same way that we speak to other physicists, because we have all these shorthands for how we talk about the world. But it's almost the same in the literature community too, right? Especially in poetry, in a genre which is so heavily influenced by tradition, that when you reference something, like when you reference Emily Dickinson, or when you reference something like that, you get these whole, all of these connotations that come with it.
And I think, I don't know, like, I did a little bit of that in my PhD, because I was talking to engineers, and you know, like, the stuff that happens in there, these little language communities are just so, I don't know, like, I feel, I do feel very much, I was talking to a person who has a linguistics degree, and they were sort of, you know, how everyone bemoans the fact that people aren't using apostrophes properly and all that sort of thing, and they were sort of talking about how languages are constantly, that is the thing about languages, that it grows and it changes, and you know, like, now we, you know, like, if we now reference Autobiography of Red, that would hold, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the very act of writing a verse narrative kind of pulls in all these other things, which is really, I don't know, like, I just find it so bizarre.
Yeah, I love, and the sequel is even better.
Oh,
if I could put in a plug for the sequel.
Yeah, let's talk about the sequel.
Because, have you read that one too?
I have not.
Yeah, it's even, I think it's, I personally think it's even better, because it takes all these, it takes some of the characters, it takes Geryon and It takes, I think, Hercules, and it puts them in middle age.
Amazing.
Or like older.
Yeah.
And then it almost doesn't even care about plot as much anymore. Like they go on a road trip and there's like, you know, a flock of bats and there's, and one of the characters is a cow and it's just, it gets a little bit even more ridiculous. Yeah. And yet there's still the same level of immersion. Like there are certain scenes where you feel connected to the character. So
yeah,
pretty crazy.
And I mean that craziness, I do wonder, there's something about prose that makes it so much harder. Do you know what I mean?
To be crazy.
And I've just been racking my brain since we started talking, trying to work out what it is about, you know, like a long form prose novel that makes it so, yeah, but then I suppose you do have science fiction and, you know, like I was just reading the blurb. There's a new Neal Stephenson book coming out next year, and like I was just reading it and I was like, oh yeah, okay, so world's destroyed by meteorites, okay, they send up an ark to a planet, everyone dies except seven women, okay, blah blah blah, and then the next sentence started, jump forward 30,000 years. And I was just thinking, I love this sort of stuff, you know. And that's what I think, you know, like stepping up to the plate as a reader and just saying, okay, he's got wings, cool, let's go. And especially with that little shortness, yeah, like the way it does it with brevity, it's bizarre.
But there is also, despite the craziness, there is sort of an emotional authenticity, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing I get confused about. That's what I think made me, and I think that I think my resistance to the book in the beginning was a slight uneasiness. Do you know what I mean? Like the fact that, I don't know, it was sort of an existential kind of, you know, it's like, oh, I feel so bad for this person. You know, I feel, oh, that's right. You know,
and he's rad and he has wings,
Are they taking the piss? And then I thought, well, you know, I don't think this book makes any claim to sort of saying, oh, have empathy for people that are not like you. I don't think that it's kind of got any political agenda like that. But there's something about it that, just that detachment of feeling and situation, which, I don't know.
Yeah, it is very detached, yeah. And yet it attempts to be emotionally authentic. Like, it's, like he is, you know, he's also, like, a gay man, like, he's, besides being red, and he's also an artist, a photographer. So he has these sort of identities that are also not just weird. They're also normally sort of looked like disregarded in some ways in our society.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, so there is that empathy too.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, it's so good. Oh my god, now I want to read the sequel. I want to read more. So do you want to tell me anything else about the process of writing a verse narrative? Because, yeah, now I want to do one.
You should do one.
I would so love to. But I just, my poetry is so, oh god, I stopped writing poetry about, I was trying to think when I last wrote poetry in like 1994 or something. It was a long time ago.
It's time to bring it back.
Well, yeah, I was thinking, yeah, I just, it's interesting. Have you ever written prose? Like, have you ever written short stories or anything?
I've written a couple stories, but they're not so good.
That's weird, eh? Like, I bet they're not good. I mean, they're quite cool. What brought you to poetry, do you think? Like,
I think the lyric form, actually. I think I was, you know, enticed by the short.
Even though I spend an hour on one word, but yeah. Like, come on.
Yeah, because then you can be a perfectionist, and also, yeah, like if you can spend, you know, an hour on, you know, two lines, and make them perfect, they might not actually end up perfect, but at least you can have that sense of, you know, I put as much effort as I possibly could into this little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like that idea of perfectionism, because I do feel like that with, you know, like, I do feel that is something I really miss about poetry, is it's like trying to squeeze the lobster into the box, you know, and then, you know, and I think, you know, I just love that, you know, it can just, like, it can kill you, you know, like, it can break your heart, and you're like, oh, so much depends, you know, and it's just like, oh my god, yeah.
But it's also incredibly subjective, right, because if you only have, you know, 50 words on a page, a word meaning something slightly different for a different person can change the whole poem.
How do you, that's something I've always wanted to talk to poets about, is like, how do you have the bravery to do that? Like, I think a lot of my writing is about control freak stuff, you know. I'm like, do you understand this is a bad man? This is a very, very bad man. Bad man. And yet, you know, like, I'm always trying to be ambiguous, but I just, I mean, that takes some chutzpah to kind of, you know what I mean, like, to sort of say, here I am in 50 words on the page, or here I am, you know, here's what I've made in, you know, like, three lines, or, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel any sense of that, or?
Yeah. I think, yeah, I do. It's a bit disconcerting. But then there's also, you can always fall back on, like, the new critic thing. Like, you can always be like, oh, yes, this is a work in and of itself, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, if I reference volcanoes here and I reference volcanoes here, I'm being, you know, I'm being intentional about it.
Yeah.
You know?
I so love that.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, because I've seen you read a couple of times, and you're not, I didn't find you to be a poet that gives a lot of, sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, there wasn't a lot of, oh, this is a poem about this, and this is in it, and this is in it, and you better be feeling this way by the
yeah.
end. Yeah. Do you, when you do read, do you feel any sense that you, or when you, say, when you have something published, do you want to put something in your bio note saying, oh, you know, this is about 1960s, I don't know.
Yeah,
stamp
yeah.
Stamp or something? Or?
Yeah, I mean, like, I have the urge to do it, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I don't know, because I did, in my last workshop, we had, like, a reprise workshop at the very
great.
End.
Cool.
And I wrote sort of a little, because after the previous workshop, Halidon suggested, well, why don't you just write sort of a prosy introduction.
Yeah.
And
yep.
also, like, a background, so that you know what you're doing, so that when you reference things, you at least have this internal sort of
yeah.
benchmark to reference them to. And so I did that, and then I showed it to the class, and they were like, that's not really... It's not necessary,
awesome.
You know? And, yeah, I think allowing something to stand on its own, although then, you know, this book has a lot of context,
yeah.
but it's almost, the context is so different and interesting, I think just layering sort of meaning on top of each other in order to get the book to be super clear is not necessary in some cases, especially with poetry.
Yeah. And because that's the other thing that I've really noticed, you know, like, is that if I do try and control things too tightly, I miss readings that might be better than my own reading. You know what I mean? Like, every now and then, you know, someone will come to me and say, oh, I really like that story that's about X. And I'll be like, oh, no, you know, I think you'll find. And then I think, actually, that's a beautiful reading, you know. And I've had the opposite happen as well, you know. I've had people come to me and say things that I've just been horrified about. But I just, I think that, yeah, if you're not too, you know, fixated about that, it's quite a nice feeling to give it away.
Yeah, and sometimes, especially with poetry or something that's autobiographical,
yeah,
maybe nonfiction and memoir, there's a sense that you can write something and then sort of it comes out subconsciously almost,
meaning
that you intend to bring across.
Yeah.
So, for example, in my first narrative, there's a part where he's trapped in a room, and Helen was, like, reading that as sort of, that's the central conflict, right? He's trapped in the, you know, in this place that's not his own, which is sort of a semi-autobiographical reading of my life at that time, because I was, like, kind of homesick. So you get that, if somebody reads it, and they're not in your head.
Yeah.
And then they tell you about it, that can give you another layer of meaning.
Yeah. And I think that's really useful as well, that idea that someone will say to you, oh, this is the central, you know, because I'll be like over here, la da da la da da, and they're like, actually, the thing that breaks my heart's actually back here. I think you're playing in the wrong place, So what are your plans from here? Like, you're almost done, the MA is just about done, eh?
Yeah, the MA just finished. Couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'm co-editing Turbine.
Yeah.
So
oh, great.
Yeah. So that will come out on December 8th.
Oh, great.
If people are interested.
It would be amazing.
Yeah. Some great poems in there.
Yeah.
And then I'll travel for about a month and then I'll go home.
Oh, that's...
Yeah.
And home is...
New York.
Cool.
Yeah.
That'll be nice.
Yeah.
That'll be amazing. And then you start your life as a... did you come straight from school to here or...?
I took... we have opposite academic years.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so I took about 8 months off. Cool. Yeah.
This is a really cheeky question. But I like asking writers it. How do you make money while you're writing?
Right now?
Anytime. Like, I mean, you know, like, I don't know. Like,
It's a brilliant question. I was on a Fulbright scholarship.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was funded. Just finished.
Yeah.
This week is the last week. I have some money saved, so I'm going to use that to travel.
Cool.
And then when I get home, I don't know, I'll find a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What sort of job do you imagine would be the perfect job for a verse novelist poet?
I have no idea. I mean, I originally wanted to sort of keep going to school, but I kind of want to, like, have a real job now.
Yeah.
Because I think...
Yeah. Do that to you.
yeah. I mean, there are a lot of really cool nonfiction writers in our in our stream, and there was sort of this argument that we would have multiple times, which is about, like, do you need to be a real person to write? Do you need to get out of the academy to write? And that I think that's a really good question. So I'm gonna try.
Yeah.
To do that.
I've been thinking about it all week. I've been thinking about stacking shelves at supermarkets. I've been thinking about, like, barista, maybe cafe.
Yeah.
You get to meet a lot of people. And then I just thought that it's really sad because I was talking to a friend about this the other day. Like, when I was a kid, when I was in my 20s, I had a partner who played in a band, and, you know, they were quite a good band, and what they would do to make money is they all had these little retail jobs.
Yeah.
And they would be given, you know, 3 days of the week they would work, and then they'd get the weekend. You know, they could always plan around it. But I was just, you know, this week with, like, 0-hour contracts and the casualization of the workforce and all those great jobs for artists, I don't know where they've gone.
Yeah, you sort of have to... Well, I mean, Anne Carson is a professor of Greek.
Yeah, so that helps. You just need to do that.
Yeah.
You just need to be a professor of Greek.
Yeah,
like, I guess teaching is the best thing, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in it because I think I mean, obviously we're not, oh, maybe you could write a science fiction novel. Do they sell well? Maybe.
I don't know if well enough to.
we're slipping into career advice now.
I did interviews for the Our Angels OK collaboration, so I interviewed a few New Zealand writers. Yeah, and there's some really interesting, like Glenn Calhoun is a doctor.
Yeah.
And Jo Randerson describes herself as like an artistic entrepreneur, which
is
really cool. So there are some cool jobs.
Be awesome. So what got you into interviewing for Our Angels OK? That's cool.
Yeah, so that was sort of the hook of the Fulbright.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I look forward to reading that as well.
Yeah.
It'll be really cool. I don't really have any more questions. Do you have anything you want to say left? I don't want to ask you one thing. What's the process of editing like? Like, what's been the process of editing Turbine? Have you done that? Oh, you've done that before, though, eh? Like,
I've done it on, like, a smaller scale.
Yeah. Because you work well with literary journals in the States. Right? Yeah.
Turbine is a big journal because it's online, but it's about 30 poets, which is a big... And there were a lot of submissions, so it was difficult. And also, we had a co-editor, which was really interesting. So
that'd be really interesting.
Yeah. So Ben and I both read everything.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Which I thought was a really good process, and then so it was sort of a matching almost more than a. I think it's almost better with two editors because then. In two people agreeing with it, there's sort of this validation of, yes, I like the poem, I like the poem too. Yeah.
And I love that idea, like, that's such the overused word of the year, but that idea of sort of curating a thing rather than, you know, like, yeah, I really am quite looking forward to reading it because I like that idea that things sort of speak to each other, and that's, I just love literary journals. I just think they're so great in that way that it becomes like the best mixtape ever, you know.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, this one says something interesting about that one. It's really cool. Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been great talking to you. And thanks heaps. And good luck with the trip and the travelling.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Yay.